Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Addisk, and James Corbett of the Corbett Report will be joining you immediately following the first commercial break of the program in 20 minutes. But first, let's get started with the market report for Thursday, June 23rd, 2016. And, of course, everyone is waiting for the results of the vote out of England. It really is amazing how all eyes are focused on this vote. It is historic for them. And certainly you hear all types of discussions and reports and opinions and analysis and what will happen if they don't or if they do and what will happen to the markets. And, you know the European Union, Germany, that if they don't want it, they're going to have to dish out tons more money to all that immigration and everything else. So, but I have a feeling that they will remain in the European Union. But it would be interesting if they did vote to pull out. But we'll just have to wait and see. So there's no final count of the votes yet. I believe we'll get them later. I think there's like a 6-hour difference. And you know, it's funny. You can read various articles on, you know, when they vote, when they close, and so forth. But the last time I checked, it could be as late as 10 o'clock in the evening. It does seem to be a very close race, though, between the two. So gold today, the stock markets reflected that the Britain will remain. Gold, a little pressure on gold, down 8 at 1,258. Silver was still up by 7 cents at 17.41. Platinum was down 9 at 970. Palladium was up 5 at 569. The USDX today was weaker earlier in the day, just by a tad, 0.06 at 93.44. Crude oil was up 0.95, back at that 50 level, 50.08. And the paper markets today, let me bring them up. The Dow was triple digits, almost 200 points earlier in the day. Let's see where it closed. I'll be bringing it up here shortly, folks. Yeah, the Dow, well, it did go over 200, 230 points at 18,011. The NASDAQ up 76 at 49.10. S&P up 27 at 21.13. 10-year yield, 1.74%. Euro did get stronger, 1.14, up 0.44. So gold really did quite well, considering you have the markets up, you know, over 1.25%. The European, London, and Germany was up almost 2%. They're back up over 10,000. London is back up over 6,000, and they were both up. You know, London was up about 1.25%, pretty much the same as us, and Germany was up almost 2%. So, again, they're all expecting the outcome to remain, and so you're seeing the strength in the markets. And, you know, you read various different reports, and it's interesting, they said that the older people in Britain were the ones who wanted to remove themselves from the European Union, and it was the younger people who want the access to all the other countries. They're the ones who wanted to remain. So again, it's like, you know, us older folks, we kind of know what's going on and we really do know what's better for you, because, you know, we've been there, done that, and we've had, all so many years to see the outcomes in various places around the world where it just doesn't work. And, so again, it would be in the best interest of Britain, to pull away from the European Union, but we'll have to wait and see. Maybe we'll wake up tomorrow morning and it'll show us that they pulled out of the European Union, and markets are down thousands of points. We could possibly see that. But gold prices, I think we could have a knee-jerk reaction if the vote is to remain. But I think you're going to see, you know, gold trade between, you know, around this level, maybe 1230, 1270. We're going to be in this tight trading range until after the 4th of July. There's going to be lots of distractions in July. We've got the both the RNC and the DNC conventions. Good Lord, heaven help us through this month of July. So it could be a very active month for gold. So, you know, people aren't going to be paying a lot of attention. Of course, we always have summer. You have a little bit of the summer doldrums through the months. But like 2008, the markets began to fall apart in the summer, as we saw last year. Things popped out of the blue. It started going into July on a slow note. And the next thing you know, silver was moving up. China was devaluing their currency. You couldn't buy silver product. Things got crazy just in a matter of a day or two. So we could see that again this year. But briefly, you know, there was big things in the news today, crazy things in the news today. I'm just going to touch on briefly. Then I've got some, you know, financial news to talk about. I just want to mention, I saw a few videos of where the, I'm sorry. First, I wanted to talk to about Obama and the Supreme Court ruling and Obama's response. And you would think with his response, it would be enough to have him thrown out of office. But we all know that the boys in Congress or the Senate don't have enough backbone to do anything about it. I'm sure you already heard this. There was a tie vote by the Supreme Court in blocking Obama's immigration plan that had sought to shield millions, up to 4 or 5 million living in the U.S. illegally from deportation. So the one-sentence opinion effectively kills the plan for the duration of Obama's presidency. It doesn't set any type of national precedent, but it doesn't even place the ruling by the lower courts. In this case, the Federal Appeals Court in New Orleans said the Obama administration lacked the authority to shield up to 4 million immigrants, that number was higher, but from deportation and make them eligible for work permits without approval from Congress. But oh no. President Obama said, yeah, most illegal immigrants still won't be deported, even after the Supreme Court's tie ruling today. He's assured these illegal immigrants with ties to the U.S. that they are low priorities. Isn't that enough to get him kicked out of office? He's just going against and not doing what he's supposed to be doing. He's ignoring the laws. So, I mean, it's not the first time. But, I mean, you know, hey, this is the most obvious, but he only has six more months, so I guess they probably won't do anything about it. But it truly is amazing. He just comes out and says, hey, No, don't worry about it. We're not gonna listen to the Supreme Court. Yeah, don't worry about it. Be happy. I mean, it blows my mind. It just shows how crazy this world really is. And I don't know if any of you saw the video of what happened last night with the Democrats and their folly with gun control when they were, you know, having a doing a sit-in at the House of Representatives with a 20. They had a 26-hour sit-in at the Capitol. They're actually claiming victory. Georgia Representative John Lewis. Oh, he seems like a nut, a dangerous one at that. And they failed to get the Republicans to vote on two controversial gun control bills. John Lewis said they got the point across to the American people. Really? I don't think so. I don't think everyone's gotten the point. He says by sitting in, we're really standing up for the rest of America. No, I don't think you are. He says it's a struggle that lasts for one day, one week, one month, one year. No, I don't think so. He says eventually those who favor gun policy reforms will win. No, Mr. Lewis, I beg to disagree with you. You will not win. But I mean, if you watched any of these videos, I mean, they're crazy. They're nuts. And it's just, it's like in the air. And it's just another sign of where we're headed in this country. But yet, hey, if the stock market is up to 18,000 once again and the NASDAQ close to 5,000, you know, everything is just fine. Don't worry about it. But yet the inside of this country is just being, it's just like ready to blow up. And I believe it's going to blow up. So we'll probably get a little more into it. Maybe even Al, and I hadn't had a chance to listen to Corbett and Al last night. So maybe they even got into it a little bit today. Well, you know, you'll hear it in the next view. But I'm going to get back to the finances. If you haven't, we'll talk a little bit about it tomorrow because they are important issues. And I think Al is a good one to see what he has to say. U.S. companies. I'm talking about the stock market at 18,000. U.S. companies and the S&P 500. We talk about this all the time, buying back their own shares. Well, they bought it back at a record pace, the 12 months ending in March. But what did it do? The buybacks did very little to lift the stock market, as the benchmark was actually down about 1% during that same period. During the March 2015 to March 2016, the U.S. companies spent a record $500 billion in repurchases. And this was released Wednesday by the S&P Dow Jones indices. This has eclipsed the previous record of $589 billion set during the market peak in 2007. Gee, folks, do you think that's any coincidence? Do you think that's any coincidence that even in 2007, when we're talking about right here with this program, 2006, well, prior to that, but for this particular instance, that they were doing all these buybacks and they were all hitting these market peaks in 2007 right before it collapses? Coincidence that it's doing it again? Companies in the S&P 500 spent $161 billion buying back shares just in the first quarter of 2016. This is the second largest amount on record, again, supporting the stock prices amid the index's early year drop. So, hey, you know what? If the market drops a little bit, you know, we'll just go out and borrow some money at the lowest rates. We know Janet Yellen, she can't ever raise rates. So we'll go out and get some cheap money. We'll come back. We'll buy up our own shares and we'll keep that stock market and our shares and our dividends going to the investors out there because they don't have a clue. You don't have to pay them a lot, but just give them a little bit and they'll be happy and they'll keep buying and we'll just keep giving them a little few dividends until it actually does crash. You know, and it's just crazy, just absolutely crazy. And these companies are going to continue to increase their buybacks. And as I mentioned, they can still borrow at extremely cheap rates. And so what else? But yet, does anybody ever talk about it? Does anybody ever tell you to get your money out of the stock market? No, there's people out there that are trying to tell you to get into to penny stocks, to penny miners. Do you know how risky they are? Do you know how easy they're manipulated? It doesn't take a lot of money to push those shares, those penny stocks. And then when they get to a certain point, guess what? All of a sudden, those that, and I'm not saying it's going on, but I remember reports where people went to jail for this. It's easy to manipulate the prices. You get enough people going in there buying, it's the old pump and dump scheme that's going on. It's a little old Ponzi scheme. And you get the new money to keep buying it. You go in there and you dump them and you pull out your money. And eventually it crashes. And they're good at it. I'm not saying that's the same with every penny stock or miner stock that you put. I'm not talking about good mining shares. I'm talking about these penny shares, these penny stocks. They lure you in with fear that you're going to lose all your money in the stock market, and then they switch you to greed. And you know, with the promises of making, you know, 800% on your money. And so they draw you in on that fear, wanting to protect what you have, which is a good thing. You should be buying physical gold and silver to do that. And 5 and 10% is not going to protect you, but, and then they lure you in saying you're being protected with that 5 to 10% of physical gold, and then you slant, and then they have you in their palm, and they turn you into greed, and then the next thing you know, you're buying up a lot of paper, more than what you should have. Companies have spent roughly $5 trillion buying their own shares since 2005. And that's according to Barini Associates. So if you're an investor, this makes you very happy. As a buyback, it means it increases the earnings per share by reducing the stock outstanding. But what does it really tell you about our economy? It is not even about using the extra cash to invest in expanding their business or perhaps creating jobs. You can't expand your business when there's no consumers to support it. And when you have the central banks around the world are keeping rates so low, you know, why wouldn't they? They're the ones that are getting extremely wealthy. But these are the fundamentals of the stock market. The paper markets, the only future direction is down, is a huge correction. Sales of newly built homes slipped in May after touching a post-recession high in April. April was revised down to 586, where it was initially estimated at 619,000, and that was April. But despite the downward revisions, April's gain was still the fastest pace since February 2008. Again, coincidence? Another comparison to the Great Recession prior to, leading up to. Again, you're going to see the same things. You should be able to see this. If you see the same things, you can't expect a different outcome. You're going to get the same outcome as we got in 08, 09, and in 10. The only difference is there isn't going to be any bailouts after 2010. There's not going to be quantitative easing to the degree that they did after 2010. Newly built homes make up just a tenth of all home purchases, and figures are often subject to large revisions. And again, I'm out of time. You know, 20 minutes goes real quick, and so you guys got to stay tuned. Give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. We got some great prices on all of our gold and silver coins. And again, I don't see much change in gold, no matter what the Brits do. And stay tuned. Al and James will be with you in just a few short minutes.
prostate count high? Half of all men over 50 have an enlarged prostate. You can shrink your prostate without harmful drugs or risky surgery. The secret to healing the prostate is to cleanse the prostate and the liver. Call Apothecary Herbs to ask about the Prostate Kit for a comprehensive way to heal and soothe your prostate. Educate yourself on how easy it can be to disinfect, cleanse, and restore your prostate gland. Call Apothecary Herbs for the Prostate Kit and successfully reduce swelling, inflammation, dissolve stones, and cleanse the blood to obtain the results you need. Money-back guarantee with every purchase. Call the experts in organ cleansing. Call Apothecary Herbs now for the Prostate Kit and empower yourself. Toll free 866-229-3663 for international callers 704-875-8010. That's toll free 866-229-3663 or visit the web at thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now. American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices. I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Our guest, as is usually the case on this date and time of the week, James Corbett from The Corbett Report, CorbettReport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T. James is he's been living in Japan since 2004. And he generates a number of podcasts, videos, articles on his blog. Prolific writer and author and commentator. Focusing on an independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. Hello, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, but you're making me start to feel old. 2004 actually does seem like
Don't waste my time telling me that you're feeling old, James. You're going to get no sympathy out of me on that. You're at least 30, 40 years younger than I am, half my age probably. You may have read the article by Paul Craig Roberts entitled "Brexit: What Is It All About?" Did you see that?
I haven't, no.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting article. And he's talking about what is happening and why we're having this Brexit drama, and that some English believe that their country's culture is being destroyed by an invasion of immigrants, and others say that it's not really an invasion because they're not armed. One of the things that crosses my mind, do these immigrants, do they need guns to get into England, given that the government of England is essentially siding with them?
I mean, the English government is providing their guns. They don't need guns. It's the same thing as happening in this country with illegal aliens coming across the border. They don't need guns to break into this country. We aren't defending our borders. Our government is allowing it. They are essentially... Do you see my point?
I do. I do. I think you're right. I mean, I think here's I suppose if this was the central issue about Brexit, which I don't think it is, but since it is politically perhaps in the minds of a lot of the public the central issue, then the real question is, yes, okay, but what are you going to do after the Brexit? Because you're still going to have the same politicians in charge, and they are still going to be siding with the policies that you don't want. Now, the real point of this, the real heart of the issue then, is about trying to get power at least down to a more accountable level. And so it's about decentralization and getting away from Brussels, so that the public can then throw the bums out and elect a bunch of politicians who actually would do what they want. Of course, we know that's not how it really works. It's never how it works. The oligarchy never gives up power through the voting process. So I guess I'm going to come down on the very, very cynical side of all of this and say they're not going to vote for Brexit. Even if they did, they're going to steal the vote. And even if they didn't steal the vote, they're not going to do what the public wants anyway. So that's my
I get what you're saying, because there's a 2-year gap from if their vote is tomorrow, or it'll be today, actually, when this program is rebroadcast, it'll be today. But even if they vote for Brexit, they'll spend 2 years, as I understand it, negotiating the exit. They won't actually get out for another 2 years from now.
It's even worse than that, because even the BBC and Business Insider and others are, as they report, this is not a legally binding referendum, so the Parliament does not have to do anything as a result of this, and the Parliament is lopsidedly in favor of Remain. I can't remember the exact numbers. I think it's 420 odd members of Parliament for remaining and 120 for breaking away or something along those lines. So they can put all sorts of parliamentary brakes on anything, even if they were to go ahead with this. So, yes, it is certainly by no means that this is going to mean overnight we're going to see some sort of drastic change. It will be a long, lengthy political negotiation process if it happens at all.
Well, Paul Craig Roberts has a take on this that I haven't heard before, and I find it fascinating. He says opposition to Brexit is based on two powerful interests in Washington. One is the interest of the New York banks and Wall Street to eliminate the United Kingdom as a financial center competitor. Right? What he's essentially saying is that once England is officially and absolutely grafted into the United or into the European Union, they will ultimately have to give up their central bank. They'll have to start using the euro. And Paul Craig Roberts says you can't be a financial center if you're not printing your own currency. You don't have your own central bank. So he's saying once, if England can be assimilated into the European Union, fully assimilated, Washington or Wall Street and the Federal Bank and the Federal Reserve is going to run the show from here on out. Wall Street understands that the defeat of Brexit means a shortened lifespan for London as a financial center. And it's impossible to be a financial center again unless the country has its own currency and central bank. He says this is the first interest. These people want England to stay in the European Union. They don't want them to break free. They're against the Brexit. And the other one, he says, as CIA documents found in the U.S. National Archives make clear, the European Union was a CIA initiative, the purpose of which is to make it easy for Washington to exercise political control over Europe. It's much easier for Washington to control the European Union than 28 separate countries. All right. What do you think about these two explanations for why, who's in favor in the United States for remaining, England remaining in the European Union?
Well, I certainly see the point that is being made, but I think I would dispute the mechanics of what's being suggested there, because I personally don't think that Wall Street is quaking in their boots as at the City of London as a financial competitor, because I think the financial interests that control Wall Street are the same financial interests that control the City of London. I don't think there's a lot of separation there, and I certainly don't think there's national rivalries that come into play when you're talking about that level of interconnectedness. Of any polities on the planet, I can't think of any that would be more closely intertwined than specifically the City of London and Wall Street. I think they're absolutely joined at the hip, if not the exact same thing. So I don't think there's any real fear there, and that's why I think the British economic establishment has lined up so firmly on the side of Remain, with 600 economists, or there are different numbers thrown around, but all the main economists at all the main schools and all the main think tanks in the UK have firmly sided with we should have to stay in the EU, because I think the underlying point is true that obviously I think these financial interests do want a European central bank that has real monetary teeth and power, and they do want to subsume monetary powers into this bigger organization, because of course they will populate that organization, they will control it, it will be their interests in charge of that, so they want more power and control, and less of a chance that the UK public, the British public, can ever vote out the bums and actually do any sort of damage to their system. So I think that the end goal, and I agree with what's being said there, but I don't frame it in terms of national rivalry or Wall Street versus London. I think that's far too naive. On the other point of the CIA and the creation of the European Union, that's interesting. I would like to see more specific information on that. I've documented a number of times in the past about the creation of the European Union coming specifically from a couple of sources. There was, for example, I want to say the Red House meeting was what it was referred to, but there was a meeting towards the end of World War II where key German officials were taking part in, and it was the idea, well, the Third Reich is clearly going down, we need a Fourth Reich, which will be basically the European Union. It was they were talking about the idea of merging and subsuming sort of the European identity, going underground, as it were. That was some of the earliest iterations of that talk in a political sense in the mid-20th century. But by 1955, by the second ever Bilderberg meeting, it was explicitly on the table and discussed at that Bilderberg meeting. We have minutes of that meeting. We have recordings of things that were said at that meeting. We have even the BBC came out about 10 years ago with a radio documentary talking about how, hey, did you know the European Union was really formed at Bilderberg? So we know that there are subterfuge and underhanded forces that have been behind the creation of this union for a very, very, very long time. I haven't heard of the CIA's role in particular, except as I suppose that CIA relates into the Bilderberg crowd.
Well, I'm just surprised to hear this information coming from Paul Craig Roberts, who I regard as a reliable source and rational and the rest of that sort of thing. If it were someone else making these allegations, I'd probably just write them off and say, well, we'll watch and see. But Paul Craig Roberts, I'm inclined to sit back and say, that sounds, I'm not telling everyone or anyone that this is God's own truth, but it does sound credible given the source. Let's talk a little bit about fracking. Ms. Shedlock's Global Economic Trend Analysis had an article on fracking. Says fracking, serious environmental concerns, that's hardly news. But hydraulic fracking, commonly called fracking, is a technique to use to extract oil and natural gas from wells. Fracking refers to how rock is fractured apart by high-pressure mixture of water, chemicals, and sand. The process is controversial. Proponents say fracking is safe, but concerns abound. Is fracking really safe? Is that something you follow at all? Do you think fracking is safe, or are we almost certainly going to contaminate or even destroy our water aquifers?
I absolutely do not have the technical expertise or have put in the time to really give an answer to that question. That's way, way beyond my pay grade. I don't study that issue, but I do know it is the political football. And in fact, just a few hours ago, as we record this conversation, it seems that a federal judge has just struck down Obama's proposed regulations on fracking on public lands. So apparently they're going to go ahead with fracking on public lands, at least in the meantime, at least until that that regulation is appealed. So I'm not sure where that's going to stand. But in terms of where this plays out, obviously, all I know for sure, there are obvious corporate interests in ensuring that any negative information about fracking is heavily suppressed. But then there are also, on the other side of the ledger, there are interests in the alternative, so-called alternative energy industry with the wind turbines and the solar panels that are supposedly going to power industry of the 21st century, that have their own corporate and monetary interests for trying to dismiss anything that would actually increase oil dependency in the United States. So all I know is that any information has to be looked at with a grain of salt, taken with a grain of salt, and looked at very carefully for the potential biases that it comes with.
I agree that the biases are just as thick as the oil. We should probably do something about fracking the spokesman for the oil industry and for the opponents, if we could frack them where we could get some truth out of them rather than just hooray for our side. Now let's move on to one more. There's something. Now this is interesting. This is an article from the Daily Reckoning. And the headline is, "The Laws of Economics Say That China Is Headed for a Great Depression." And they advance a very interesting theory here. Capitalism was driven by investment, savings, capital accumulation, reinvestment, and capital accumulation, but history got in the way. In yesterday's Daily Reckoning, economist and author Richard Duncan explained creditism, not capitalism, creditism, and I would say debtism as opposed to creditism, but regardless. And he explained creditism and how it came to replace good old-fashioned capitalism, now dead beyond recall. Do you think capitalism is dead beyond recall?
If it was ever really here, yeah, to the extent that it's ever really existed. I agree with that assessment. Certainly what we have is not capitalism in the sense that it was, that it has been defined economically speaking. It brings with it, of course, all of the political baggage that has accumulated over the centuries and has really transformed it into what we understand today, which has to be described as a corporate crony government-led system that also, of course, relies on credit creation, which is the core of the monetary system of basically every nation on the planet. Plus, on top of that, we have the casino economy that has really taken off in the last few decades, where you have derivatives and then derivatives based on derivatives and then derivatives betting on derivatives going down and that kind of craziness where you have, you know, trillions, hundreds of trillions, quadrillions. No one really knows how much money, theoretical money, is theoretically on the line if this system melts down. So, yeah, I think what we have is something certainly not what most people would think of if they were to sit down and try to define what capitalism is. And that, of course, applies even more so in China, which has never really claimed to be capitalist, but capitalist with Chinese characteristics, I think is the phrase the government likes to use. But of course, all that means is directed by the Bank of China.
I doubt that we've had capitalism since at least 1971. In my opinion, if you're going to have capitalism, you need real capital. And this creditism, which I would say debtism myself, but it's the same, two sides of the same coin. What we're talking about is a system of economics that's based on our credit, our debt, our promises to pay, while capitalism is based on actual payments that are derived from production. Capitalism depends on productivity. Creditism merely depends on your credit rating. As long as you've got a good credit rating, you can keep on borrowing more currency and going deeper into debt and stimulating your economy and raising and improving your business or whatever. But I look at this, and one is based on productivity, the other one is based on debt, promises, mere promises to pay. I can't see a happy ending for creditism. And to me, the only way this is going to work is sooner or later. I don't know how many people are going to have to starve, but sooner or later, someone's going to have to say, you know, maybe we're going to try capitalism again, see how that works. It won't be a popular idea, but it may be the time has come. We'll get into this a little bit more when we return. I'm Alfred Adusk here on Financial Survival with our guest James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com.
Job stress, financial obligations, or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at the 3Ws.thepowerherbs.com.
Prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
I'm Alfred Addis. You're on Financial Survival with our guest, James Corbett from the Corbett Reports, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. We were talking about an article that was based on an article in Daily Reckoning that referenced comments by Richard Duncan, who explained the term creditism as compared to capitalism. And I think it's a clever, I don't know that Duncan is the originator of the term, but I think it's a clever insight. Again, I'd say debtism rather than capitalism. The article concludes in China today, for many of these countries, the rapid accumulation of dollar reserves proved to be a curse rather than a blessing. What he's talking about, the world sent goods to America, but the world didn't get American goods in return. All it got was paper dollars. And the rapid accumulation of dollar reserves proved to be a curse rather than a blessing. The sharp growth of the reserves created a domestic investment boom accompanied by rampant asset price inflation, eventually ended in financial disaster. The bubble economy that developed in Japan during the 80s is a perfect illustration, as is the Asian miracle bubble that followed in the 1990s, or China today. Global recession looms once again. World central banks are out of tools. Chinese export-based economic model that creditism birthed is crumbling, and it could drag the rest of the world down with it. I don't know if you're... I mean, the term creditism is new to me. I don't know if it's new to you or not. Is it?
As far as I know, this is a coinage of Robert Duncan, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think it's a nice insight.
I think it's important, but I want to separate out a couple of things here, because when we talk about capitalism, theoretically, we're referring back to the identification of the system that arose with the advent of the modern system of industrial production, primarily through the Industrial Revolution, and then contrasted with socialism and Marxism, which of course were coming up as alternative theories. And that has to do with the relationship of ownership of the means of production, who owns the means of production, and then how do they use them. And of course, in capitalism, there is a capitalist class that invests private capital in businesses to accumulate capital goods, which then create products, which then are sold for profit, and then those profits are reinvested.
Generates
back
more
into capital
which, if it's saved, so invested, and so on.
So that's capitalism, if we're talking about capitalism per se. Mm-hmm. And creditism, I think, does strike on something that is important in the modern era, but that goes not to the ownership of the means of production or anything of that. It has to do with the monetary system that this is all based on. And the monetary system is a separate thing. You can and do and would, presumably, have credit functioning, even in a purely capitalist system. There would be banks or some sort of financial institutions. There would be credit. Capitalists would borrow in order to invest in something that they think is going to be profitable in the future. That would all exist. What would be potentially different is the idea of a monetary system that is controlled by a central bank, that is based on debt, that is issued by private banks at interest. That does not have to be the way that the monetary system itself is set up. And when it is, I think that this creditism is the logical outcome of that. It creates a system that is based on debt growth, that requires more debt in order to grow, and also has the corollary that if everyone paid off all of their debts to the banks, there would be no money left, because the money supply is literally created out of debt. It is retired as debt. If we retired all the debt, we would have no money left except for the coins and bills that are printed up, which is a fraction of the overall money supply. So that's the real issue here, I think, is the monetary system. And until we understand that monetary reform is really the crux of this problem that has festered around the globe, until we once again understand, as people did a century ago, that it's the question of a central bank and what does a central bank do? Do we need one? What power should it have? That is the central issue of all of the politics. And it is absolutely no coincidence that 1913 was the creation of the Federal Reserve, and within 3 years you have the United States involved in, or 4 years, you have the United States involved in World War.
In fact, according to this article, you're referring to the First World War. This article specifically refers to beating the Nazis with creditism, destroying the Soviet Union with creditism, meaning we didn't win the war because we were necessarily technologically superior. We were, in my opinion, but we won it because we had a higher credit rating. We could go deeper into debt than the Nazis, so we beat them with debt. There's a lot to recommend creditism, but insofar as it's based on debt, you have to get to a point where sooner or later somebody says, you know, $20 trillion is a pretty big national debt. Do you think we can pay it? And other people say it doesn't matter because the debt is really $100 trillion. And some people say it's over $200 trillion. Can't be paid. And wipe out the debt, you wipe out the correlative paper assets. But now what are you going to do?
In fact, that assessment of World War II is perhaps even more apt than that description gives credit for, because, of course, what was the thing that was the political impetus for the rise of the Nazi regime and the outbreak of war was the reparations payments that Germany mm-hmm. was forced to make after World War I, which, of course, it was not financially possible for it to ever actually really pay off, which caused the economic crises that led to the political instability in Germany. And on top of that, then you have the German government really functioning not only through its interlocking with various corporate frameworks in the United States and elsewhere, especially through IG Farben and others that had direct tie-ins to Standard Oil in the United States, but also there's the banking side of it. And the German banking system was, again, really supported and kept functioning through the international banking system that tied in through the Bank of International Settlements, which was created, at least ostensibly, as part of the way that Germany was going to manage its payments for the reparations. So it's all an interlocking financial system that has to do with the banking interlocks that were created by the bankers. And like every other major war in history, the bankers fund both sides, and they get to choose who wins by calling in debts here or letting the money flow there. And that's exactly the way World War II functioned.
Do we really fight any wars with bullets and blood anymore? We watch the movies. We have these young heroes running around. Some of them get killed and some of them get to be heroes and go home in the movies. But is the war really fought by the people who pick up rifles, or is it fought by people that are sitting in boardrooms at long tables, green lights and the rest of that sort of thing, that are fussing over a fraction of a percent on interest rates?
Yes, I think that's a good way of putting it. It is absolutely more about the economic interests that are behind war rather than some sort of die for king or country kind of nonsense that was blown apart quite literally, and certainly in the First World War, we saw the public starting to realize that war is not what it was all cracked up to be in earlier eras. And it goes even beyond that, because, of course, now we do have ongoing conflicts in Syria and Yemen and Egypt and Libya and places descending into outright violence. But when we put that in the context of global warfare, I think I just had an interview with Michelle Jasadowski that's up on my homepage right now at CorbettReport.com that I think is important in this respect, because he points out that global warfare these days is not at this point and is unlikely to be the type of hot military confrontations that we've seen in the past. Instead, it is an interlocking framework of propaganda and psyops and destabilization, political destabilizations, and primarily economic destabilization, which is really the tool that the bankers are using these days. It's more convenient. It's better able to confront big enemies through those types of operations rather than actually deploying military hardware and fighting it out on a battlefield. I don't think we can have that type of fight again between major world powers for all sorts of reasons, but also because, again, I think the infrastructure is what they actually want. They don't want to bomb the infrastructure to death. They want to make sure that that is still integrated into the global economy so they can continue to run it as they are waging, quote unquote, financial or economic or cyber warfare on their enemies.
I look at something like the Iraq War. 8.5 years we were there last time. And I don't know that we're ever going to be completely out of it, hard to say. But why do we have a war that can drag on for 8.5 years? And never gets a victory. We didn't have a victory in Vietnam, didn't have a victory in Korea, per se. These things just drag on. And I begin to wonder, is the real purpose to achieve a military victory where we say, hooray, we won? Or is the real purpose just to drag it out as long as possible in order to go deeper and deeper and deeper into debt, generate more paper debt instruments, buy more tanks and rifles and Apache helicopters and get them all blown up and build some more? What's the object of war these days?
Well, I think you just answered it quite aptly. I mean, clearly, if we're looking at confrontations in significant major sense, what on earth? I mean, ask an American anything, literally anything about Syria, let alone why the American military should in any way be involved in Syria right now. And you would get at best blank stares and probably something about, well, oil and or terrorists. We got to get them before they get us. No one has any sense whatsoever why the American military is so heavily invested in what happens in Syria and why, you know, the Assad government should or shouldn't be doing this. It really is about economic interests at this point, whether they're geopolitical, geostrategic, whether it comes down to oil, things of that nature. But it has nothing to do with any. Have you ever been killed by, you know, some Syrian or something? Have they ever attacked you? Of course, this has nothing to do with that. And that's I think we've moved into an era of human history where there just isn't that type of direct contact and conflict between the American population and most of the world. So it has to be spun through propaganda, but it always comes down to economic interests. And then how much more so when you think about the rising tensions with somewhere like Russia? Again, why on earth does America, why do they have military involvement in Ukraine? What on earth does it matter what is happening there to the average American? And again, what can the average American even tell you about Ukraine? Probably next to nothing. But oh, Putin's a bad man, so we got to be over there to make sure he doesn't get us. Again, it always comes down to that simplistic logic when self-evidently it's just about economic interests.
Saddam Hussein was a bad man, too, but didn't obscure the fact that he was actually installed by the United States, if I understand correctly. Mm-hmm. I wonder how long it's going to be before we hear reports that Putin is actually a CIA agent that's been installed at the behest of Washington and Wall Street. I don't expect that, but I'm not going to be surprised if it happens. We've got about 3 minutes left. I think you follow Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies. Am I right?
Yes. Yes.
Then you're aware that Ethereum, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, they issue their own Bitcoin, their own cryptocurrency. They were hacked and supposedly lost $50 million just in the last week or so. But here's a report from Ethereum that says Ethereum developers may be pulling a rabbit out of the hat as they secure more than 7 million Ether, that's their cryptocurrency, and suggest that there are many plans in place to attack the child DAOs. This is a technical term that is unique to Ethereum, and either block the funds or recover them that were stolen. Is that something you know about? Is it something you care to comment on in the last 2 minutes here?
It's difficult to get into all of this, but yes, it's like in the past you might have heard that Bitcoin was hacked and all this Bitcoin went missing when it was a specific exchange in Japan that basically stole from its customers and ended up going under. And so those customers lost their Bitcoin. But it's a bit like saying if Visa got hacked and your Visa information got stolen, the dollar has been hacked. I mean, that's the type of logic that's going on here. And same with Ethereum. Ethereum is a platform, and on that platform is built this thing called Decentralized Autonomous Organization, the TAO. And that was something that got hacked. So again, it's layers of nuance here that will, again, sound like absolute gobbledygook to most of the audience, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So,
but unfortunately, is it something we need to learn? Is this a wave of the future or just a flip?
I think so. Well, I think that these types of things are in fact central. As we were saying before, it all comes down to monetary policy, and if we don't understand the alternatives that actually exist, well, then we might as well just walk ourselves into the future, you know, the boot stamping on the human face forever, as Orwell put it. So I think it's extremely important that people at least understand things like Bitcoin and Ethereum. But unfortunately, the way these stories tend to get reported, it just, you know, in the minds of most people, oh, Bitcoin got hacked, Ethereum got hacked. It's not safe.
Well, what fascinates me about the article is that apparently Ethereum is responding. They're counterattacking.
Yes.
The money just didn't disappear. They figured out a way to track it. And now they're going after whoever it was that stole it, and perhaps and presumably over the computer networks themselves. Are we going to see a world where we're all tangled up in computer wars on a regular basis?
One way or another, and whether it's us or our robot proxies that will increasingly be handling every aspect of our life, it's a strange world we're going into, and I think most people aren't even aware it's coming.
We'll talk more about this strange world when we return next week. I hope you'll tune in at that time. I'll be back with James Corbett in 1 week. And in the meantime, may the good Lord bless you and me and Frank, the producer, and James Corbett. Good night, ladies and gentlemen.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. In my dream, I have a plan. If I got me a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work at all. Money, always sunny in a rich man's world.